Welcome to the 78th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chat.
And 60 years to the day after New Zealand finally recorded their first test win after 26 years of trying, welcome to the podcast that's always loved a slow starter.
This episode, however, we are raring to go and we have got all kinds of delights for you. We're going to be talking Monty Panesar and Martin Crowe, not at the same time. We're going to be talking the T20 World Cup, what a farce that's been. Talking of farces, we're also going to be talking about the Shane Warne Foundation. We're going to be reviewing the winter edition of the wonderful Night Watchman 2. Now, it's a little while since we last recorded, probably about 6 weeks or so. And so there's a lot to reflect on. Andy, what's caught your eye in that period?
Well, it seems amazing when you remember those images of Monty Panesar tearing through India back in the winter of 2012, that he's had gone on to have the few difficult years he's had. He's really struggled with his game and also really sadly has had this ongoing battle with mental illness, recent problems with attacks of paranoia. It has left him far, far from the England team. It's left him actually unable to hold down a place in any county side. So the news this week that he's back in training with his hometown club, Northants, I think is definitely a cause for cautious optimism. He really seems like someone for whom going back to a place where he's familiar, where he began his career, I think would really, really helpful for him. And where there's obviously no guarantee this will work out, and he's had a string of false starts in recent seasons. All the language coming out from this, both from his side and from Northants, suggests there's a determination to make things work. There's already been a couple of slightly presumptuous articles talking about, oh, well, England go to India and Bangladesh in the winter. Wouldn't it be great to get Monty back? I think that's so far ahead of where we are with this. I think we should really be thinking about, wouldn't it just be great to see him back, enjoying his game, playing well? Because he was such a joyous cricketer to watch back in...
He was one of those extraordinary cricketers, though, who, you know, obviously extraordinarily talented, but actually, I do wonder whether we... I often think about Monty Panesar, and you think of this guy who now is, you know, seems to be a bit of a shell of his former self, and you throw back however long it is now, you know, 8-9 years, and basically he was a figure of fun for crowds. You know, all of those times when he was out fielding and everyone, you know, in a kind of good-natured way, would sort of poke fun of him at him for the fact that he was almost completely inept. Certainly as a fielder, certainly as a batsman, obviously his bowling are completely different. Then you do wonder whether, I don't know, I personally kind of wonder whether we should feel slightly guilty as crowns for not actually taking that a bit more seriously. I realise that's kind of derailed your kind of optimism there, but I don't know whether there's anything in that.
Well, I think it's obviously very difficult from the outside to understand exactly what the problems are, but I think it's another really telling example of the way cricket does seem to put quite a unique mental strain on a lot of people at the top of the game. And I think what's particularly difficult is he was this real poster boy for the Sikh community in England. And he was seen as also just, you know, you remember his joyous bouncing celebrations when he took wickets. But you realise with what's come in the last few years that it also came with clearly a really heavy burden, a really sort of heavy, heavy sense of stress.
Now, talking of characters who... you know, have complex personalities. One of the obviously big events in cricket over the last couple of weeks has been the death of Martin Crowe, the incredibly talented New Zealand batsman and latterly commentator as well. And actually, for me, Martin Crowe is always one of these. We were chatting before the podcast, and it seems that it's sort of the same for you, Andy. Martin Crowe is one of these characters who, you know, in our kind of cricket watching time, he wasn't really around, and he's sort of always been on the periphery as a big figure in the game, but someone who never really known much about. And for me, actually, I mean, it sounds like an awful thing to say, but one of the benefits, I don't know what the right word is, but benefits certainly not the right word, of his passing has been the fact that we've had the opportunity to have some absolutely incredible tributes from people who knew him and who played with him. Obviously, his death in a sense was a long time coming. He knew it was coming. We all knew it was coming. He had a very sort of well-publicized battle with illness over a long time. But one of the things that's come out particularly since his death has been quite how complex he was as a character. And, you know, there are these astonishing accounts of him basically completely disassociating himself from his younger self. And sort of, you know, in interviews with journalists, he would say, yeah, I can completely understand why people didn't sort of like me 10 years ago. I thought I was a pretty unlikable person as well. And he actually sort of resented cricket in a way, and what cricket had done to him as a character to make him into who he was.
One of the really interesting things has been the contribution that he's made to New Zealand cricket in recent years as a sort of mentor figure. So
Ross having Taylor, realized for example, all of that,
yeah. And it's actually... It feels like something that should happen more often. You know, a lot of older players who've gone through the game and really understand it, really helping younger players. But particularly Ross Taylor talked in a very heartfelt way about the fact that Crowe was really able to get him to rethink his game. And the, I guess that the of someone who had gone through the game at its hardest, gone through all the anguish, is in a great position to pass on that sort of wisdom.
Now, from the kind of nuanced, complex characters of individual cricketers, I think we're going to turn to the joys of the 2020 World Cup, which could really have done with being a little bit more nuanced in the way it was set up. I think we're both finding.
Yeah, I think I'm still optimistic that this will, you know, will go on to be an interesting tournament. But it hasn't. I don't think it's been a great start. Afghanistan's passage to the group stage is undoubtedly a cause for celebration. You know, it's another chapter in this stunning, stunning story. But I couldn't help feeling a little sad that it came at the expense of Zimbabwe. I mean, constantly beset by turmoil, administrative chaos. I think Zimbabwe have done incredibly over the last few years to create talented sides, of very youthful and actually quite talented sides.
But the reality is that if they can't hack it and don't win, you know, if Afghanistan win more games and thrash them as they have today, yesterday, whenever it was, then surely that's just the nature of kind of knockout tournament cricket.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with the fact that, I mean, Zimbabwe, sadly, based on their current level of ability, Zimbabwe's ongoing sort of test status is a bit of an anachronism. It's a bit anachronistic, but it's kind of unfortunate that you have this setup where there's so little high-level cricket available to these smaller sides that actually you're not getting a sense that the game's being developed. You're getting a sense of sort of one in, one out. So Afghanistan are through, they'll get it. But now Zimbabwe miss out, get cast back into the wilderness, and you can't help thinking that actually the solution here is... The competition so much isn't the problem. I think the real problem is the lack of opportunity for these smaller sides to play the bigger sides.
And actually, going back, sorry, just quickly, to the line with which you opened the podcast, you look at someone like New Zealand, and if you thought, you know, if they hadn't spent 26 years solidly losing games, then they wouldn't be the side they are today. And actually, the kind of short-termism, the constant chopping and changing with the 2020 World Cup format kind of really typifies, doesn't allow actually these countries to develop in any kind of meaningful way at all.
Well, the problem is 2020 is supposed to be the best opportunities. I mean, it's by far it's the greatest leveler. You know, Zimbabwe have far better chance against India in a 2020 than they do in a test match. And I sort of thought the whole idea was that by dropping more of the smaller sides from the 50 over World Cup, we would focus on giving more and more of them the chance to play the bigger sides in the T20. And I just can't really see how I don't see why the format couldn't be rejigged in such a way that we gave a few more of the countries the opportunity for a go at the group stages. What's been upsetting you about the World 2020 Cup?
Well, actually along similar lines, that, you know, that just this thinking around the fact that one of the great things I think that the T20 does, and there's not much about T20 that I kind of really like, as listeners to this podcast will know, one of the great things it does is the fact that it's a leveler. It gives great exposure to smaller sides, and indeed it actually gives great exposure to new potential audiences for cricket as well. And so it was particularly disappointing to read a remarkable story about a cohort of Scotland cricket fans, who I imagine must be pretty few and far between, and certainly those who are willing to make the 5,000-mile trip to India are probably pretty few and far between. Anyway, they turned up in Nagpur at the stadium for their game against Zimbabwe. They journeyed all the way out there, and they were told when they got there that they weren't actually able to buy any tickets at the stadium where the game was happening. They had to go to another stadium 15 miles away with, you know, no apparent transport between the two in order to get their tickets. Actually, a whole lot of them ended up just not being able to see the game. Some of them got in because the Scotland manager just happened to have a few kind of complimentary ground passes or something in his bag and just handed them out to a few of the fans. But it's kind of, you know, what's also awful is the way the BCCI and the ICC have been kind of passing the buck between themselves about who was actually responsible for this and, you know, whose fault it was, etc., etc. But it's just astonishingly kind of disappointing when you see this opportunity to really grow the game among particular audiences, and there's just this kind of complete flagrant disregard for what it is that cricket is there to do, which is to be performed in front of people.
What made this story, I think, even more bizarre is the fact that these games weren't being played to sort of sold-out stadiums. I mean, the stadium was basically empty.
You know, yeah, they were basically empty.
You'd have thought
empty.
That with sort of a modicum of common sense, you'd be letting in anyone who was interested, anyone who wants, particularly because there's this ongoing issue for cricket that, you know, however much of the revenue of the game you get from television, the game just looks awful if it's played in front of an empty crowd. You can all get stuffed if you want to have a go at us for it, but we are very, very proud of what we have been able to achieve. In this episode from the archives, Toby is going to have a look at the growing scandal around the Shane Warne Foundation that has left the leg spinner very much on the defensive.
Cricketers and charity have never been very far apart at all. Back in the day, of course, cricketers had benefit matches, which were effectively charity collections designed to see them through their retirement when they'd stop playing. And even from the 1950s, there are a number of cricketing charities that would set up to help bring cricket to the poor and the disadvantaged. The Lord Taverners is one example of that, the primary club as well, which is open to anyone who has ever got a golden duck. So I'm certainly a member. Are you a member?
I am a member, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Just to start off with our cricketing lack of credentials. There have been a lot of individual cricketers as well who have become involved, closely involved in charity work, often because of experiences that they themselves have been through. Some of the most high profile, obviously Glenn McGrath, who set up the McGrath Foundation, which is a fundraising charity for women with breast cancer after his first wife died of cancer. Ian Botham's legendary charity walks. He did the Land's End to John O'Groats. He walked across India and did all sorts of extraordinary marathon walks. Came about after he accidentally stumbled into a children's ward and was suddenly surrounded by all of these children who he was told were going to die within the next couple of weeks. You know, a cynic might suggest that for some cricketers it's a good PR stunt as well, but actually I think, you know, for a lot of them, the kind of work that they undergo, they do put their celebrity to good use to raise money for good causes. Now, the question of motivation is certainly an important and interesting one when it comes to the Shane Warne Foundation and the pretty extraordinary story that's developed around it. Before we started recording, Andy very correctly pointed out that we don't want to end up being sued. Good publicity though it would be. So I'm going to try not be libelous at any point in this little feature. So to start with the facts, the Shane Warne Foundation was founded in 2004, obviously while Warne was still very much active as a player, and its motto was teaming up to help Aussie kids. Now, the difference between the Shane Warne Foundation and essentially all of the other work that cricketers had done in the past to raise money was that rather than raising funds specifically for a given charity or a given cause, the Shane Warne Foundation looks to raise funds generally and disperse those funds to individual charities of its choosing.
I must admit, this is one of my concerns generally around like this sort of plethora of individual foundations, and this isn't like a critique particularly of the Shane Warne Foundation, but you think that there must be a real inefficiency to having tons and tons of small foundations that all have to be administered and all have to get money and then disperse it. There's inherently a considerable arrogance in saying, actually, this brand new thing I'm going to set up is way better than anything else that you've set up. That can be slightly problematic right from the start, can't it?
I think that's very true, and I think you know, a lot about this story actually reveals things about Shane Warne, or at least things are familiar about Shane Warne's character as we've seen it develop over the years as a cricketer. Mm. In the way that he handled this whole thing, he wasn't content to say I'm going to fundraise for X, Y, and Z. He basically had to set up a new way of fundraising, and completely sort of throw out the rule book, set up a new way of fundraising, and set up his own foundation. He just wasn't, you know, he wasn't ready to say I'm just going to carry on fundraising for others. Now, you know, Warne, Warren did have his kind of own road to Damascus moment when it came to charity fundraising. He went to the US as part of a challenge trip of a lifetime program in, I think, 2003, and said he sort of realized the impact that, you know, the potential for money had on the lives of people with terminal, children with terminal diseases, in terms of giving them experiences in the last sort of months and years of their life. So I certainly don't deny the kind of the motive behind Warren wanting to do this, but certainly there was a sense that he wanted to do it in a sort of bigger and better and different way from someone else. And actually, at first, things went very well. He had some very famous and some very rich friends. They all gave some large donations to get the ball rolling. He set up the most glamorous poker nights. He had celebrity lunches. And actually, there was the advantage of sort of public notoriety when a number of reality TV, famous reality TV contestants donated their winnings to the Shane Warne Foundation. So the ability to actually raise money was never in doubt. But what really was in doubt was the business model of the whole setup, because what wasn't happening was that people were just donating money directly to charity. They were donating money to a foundation who then dispersed that money to a foundation. So there was this kind of middleman who existed. The other problem that exists at the same time is that Shane Warne is he's a man who likes glamour. He's a man who, at the time that a lot of this was happening, was dating Liz Hurley, who's, you know, which sort of just is an indication, I suppose, of the sort of part of the lifestyle he was leading. Mm. And certainly a lot of the kind of fundraisers were, you know, whereas you look at a lot of other cricketers who, and in a sense the comparison is invidious, but if you look at a lot of other cricketers who do this, they're very much getting their hands dirty during, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's Ian Botham going on long charity. Yeah. And getting the most enormous blisters, or it's, you know, Sachin Tendulkar going into, you know, genuinely going into very poor areas of India and doing work. Here was Warne having massive poker nights, very glitzy dinners.
It's a very difficult balance, though, isn't it? Because actually, Shane Warne's ability as a fundraiser is his ability to be glitzy, isn't it? It's his ability to get famous celebs and whatever in a room. So in a way, I'm not uncomfortable with that side of things. I think the glamness to get, basically to get wealthy people to want to give you a lot of money in a room. What seems to me to be the problem from this story is that it appears to have just got out of hand. So that actually the kind of fundraising thing has got forgotten amongst the sort of lifestyle side of it, the glam side of it. Mm. And you know, it's also interesting because charities are obviously very much entitled to spend some of the money they get in on further fundraising. But this sounds like, from what I've seen, that the actual sort of fundraising spending just got totally out of hand and became almost the aim in itself.
And that was the issue, basically, that all of these events just became far too expensive. And this had been apparent, you know, it is thought, there we go, here's me avoiding the lawsuit, it is thought that the foundation, the board of the foundation, realised this for a while. In October of last year, October 2015, they met. And they met in sort of in secret. No one's quite sure who was there. And they basically said to themselves, we need to sort out the financial situation. There were two sort of catalysts for this, one of which is that a Melbourne-based newspaper in Australia, The Age, was asking full copies of all of the foundation's annual financial statements, which they weren't willing to give out, which is suspicious in and of itself. And more seriously, there were rumours that the government's fundraising regulatory body was actually making inquiries around the Shane Warne Foundation.
Yeah, I mean, this is very interesting because we're in last year, there was a huge scandal in the UK around the Kids Company charity, which had been a hugely high-profile charity, backing from major celebrities, backing from the highest level of government as well. And, you know, to cut a very long story short, it went under last year after, again, ridiculous lack of control over expenditure. And I do think there's a similar story here where you have enough big names and big faces involved that actually the proper audits and checks at an early stage just aren't getting done. You know, the whole thing runs its own course. And it's only later in the day, once things get really alarming, that people start to think, oh, God, you know, we need to ask some questions.
And, know, and it run and it runs on a lot of, you know, it gets up a sort of a head of steam of good feeling and goodwill in the sense that I'll hear all of these, you know, rich and famous people coming to these events and giving money to charity and, you know, X, Y, Z. Certainly the figures that were revealed are pretty startling. It was revealed that in one particular year, I think 2014, 2015, only 25 cents in every dollar donated to the charity, to the foundation, had actually been handed on to charity, which meant that three quarters of the money that people had been giving, you know, thinking that it was going to go to charity, had actually been spent on these events. And that's the issue with this business model. These events were just so expensive that they were unsustainable. There were also, you know, all of these kind of slightly uncomfortable things came out around the fact that the office space that the foundation used had actually been rented by the foundation from Warne's parents, and similarly Warne's brother had been paid a pretty healthy salary, I think 80,000 US Australian dollars a year by the foundation as well.
Just at the moment, you're on the ground, obviously, in Australia, and you're seeing that, because this all in the UK is being reported sort of very much secondhand and in the margins. Is the feeling of the coverage at the moment very personal? I mean, are people seeing this as like a failing of Warne's character, or are people seeing this as naivety? I mean, what's the sort of general...
Well, this is interesting, because what really hasn't helped Warne is the way that he's reacted to all of this. So all of this news started leaking, and Warne appointed a new CEO in a desperate attempt to turn the company around. She resigned pretty quickly afterwards as a kind of protest resignation, basically saying that what was being publicly said about what the company would do to change its ways, what the foundation would do to change its ways, was not the same, was not what they could do to change their ways. Warne then came out and he tried to make a whole lot of statements saying, oh, it's all okay. He said the foundation had donated $7 million to charity during its life. He then retracted that. He then revised it to $4 million. He was asked for proof. He said, oh, no, it's not $4 million yet, but we're going to donate another $500,000 soon. And that whole thing, and no one could work, he couldn't prove how they were going to donate another $500,000. It all just, you know, completely unraveled and backed into a corner. Warne has kind of gone onto the offensive, and this has all really been happening in the last few weeks. He's been accusing the media of a witch hunt, and slightly unbelievably, he's been kind of saying things like, "Oh, innocent kids will be affected by these stories," and, you know, the people who are investigating it are kind of, you know, implying that they're sort of wishing harm on suffering children and things like that. So I think that really hasn't helped in terms of actually his ability to sort of stay distant from it in a way. And certainly, you know, as well as being the charity that the foundation, sorry, that bears his name, it's also one that he has enlisted all his friends to be a part of. He's very much been the face of it, and now he's really become the spokesperson for it. The latest is Warne is currently on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here in the South African jungle. He's announced before he went on that the foundation was gonna wind down. You know, and he was citing, oh, it's just, you know, all of this negative publicity and it's just not worth it anymore. But I think certainly throughout this whole story, I think we've sort of seen characteristics of Shane Warne that we've known sort of throughout his career in a way, you know, all the way from the sort of ambition and hubris to set up this new model of fundraising and sort of do it better and bigger than everyone else, all the way through to his almost kind of childlike enthusiasm and inability to see the sheer impracticality of his plan. And then, you know, subsequently, this kind of his desire to be loved is so great that now everyone's turning against him. It's this sort of sense of, right, well, I'm just going to stop doing everything altogether. To the review. Over the past couple of years, we have been happily reading The Night Watchman, which is Wisden's quarterly, as the name suggests. It comes out four times a year, and it's a collection of longer form essays. We first reviewed it in episode 45, I believe, of Reverse Web Radio, which I think was about 3 years ago. And that was actually when The Night Watchman began. And happily, I think I speak for both of us when we say that our hopes for it were very have been very much fulfilled over the last few years. So the particular edition that we're reviewing today is issue 12, which is the winter 2015-2016 edition. And Andy, what caught your eye in this?
Well, I think you talk about it having fulfilled its kind of manifesto and its excitement. I think a large part of The Night Watchman, of its appeal, is this commitment to long form. So it's about giving, in some cases, writers we're familiar with, in some cases, writers we're very much not familiar with, the opportunity to write at much greater length. And I thought what was particularly brave in this edition is the section where they have three consecutive articles on Don Bradman's quite unique approach to batting. And I thought this was quite a gamble. Because there's one thing having a long form article, it's quite another go having three back-to-back long articles on what is actually quite a narrow and quite specific topic. But I actually thought it worked rather brilliantly because you have this one topic viewed from three very different perspectives and dissected. And I thought actually it's an interesting experiment, and I think it also it kind of reflects the magazine's willingness, I think, to try stuff.
And I think talking of its willingness to try stuff, I was kind of I'm always surprised when I read The Night Watchman by the stuff that I kind of start reading thinking, oh, am I really going to enjoy this? And always end up actually enjoying it. There is an extraordinary article by a guy called Nathan Lehman. I don't know whether it's Lehman or Lemon. I presume it's not Lemon, given there's an A in there. Anyway, Nathan, apologies for probably completely butchering your name. Anyway, there's an astonishing article. So this guy, Nathan Lehman, is the analyst for the England cricket team, and he sits there poring over, a laptop screen, presumably looking at every statistic that comes out. And he wrote an article which I had to read probably four or five times before I started understanding, which is basically about batting first and whether batting first is a good thing or not. And what I really like about it article is the fact that it is completely unashamed in its complete involvement with statistics and what statistics tell you. And I think one of the points that he makes, in fact, is that you can't actually really know about these kinds of topics unless you do immerse yourself in the statistics. And no, these are astonishing. And actually, I found it quite kind of revelatory in terms of the sometimes, the really interesting statistics about it's not actually about whether you want to bat last on a deteriorating pitch. It's actually about who has the advantage after the first innings and, when actually run rates start dropping off after days in matches and all of these kinds of things, which actually I found absolutely fascinating.
And the point is, I don't think there's anywhere else in cricket journalism, and frankly, I'm not sure anywhere else in sports journalism, where someone would be given 12 pages to set out a rigorous analytical argument. And I agree with you. I found it hard going. I'm not an analyst, but I found it fascinating as well. And I think it's brilliant that The Night Watchman gives it a place. The other thing that I think is so important in the way The Night Watchman is carving out its niche is the ability it has and the freedom it has to publish some quite controversial and contrarian stuff. I'd particularly focus on Manu Joseph's article and Rahul Dravid. I mean, it's an article that has quite a subtle argument, so I'm slightly going to spoil it with this paraphrasing, but it really makes the case that there's a snobbery around Indian fans' adoration of Rahul Dravid, certainly in a part of Indian society that's a lot to do with the fact that he's very educated and some of the other Indian players are not. And I could not believe, and I'm a great fan of Crick Info, but I could not believe Crick Info would ever run a piece quite like this. It's, you would be critical of players, but to make such a sort of deep kind of criticism. And I think that's something that the magazine clearly has, a freedom that maybe not all more mainstream cricket outlets always do.
No, I think we're both happily coinciding in our thoughts on what actually the best article in the entire thing is, which is actually the first one in there.
It's a ridiculously good article, and what is particularly wonderful about Decline and Fail, which is a collaboration between Anthony McGowan, who writes particularly a lot of young adult fiction, it's a collaboration with the cartoonist Chris Riddell, and the cartoons are just beautiful. Chris Riddell does a variety of wonderful work. I'm particularly fond, on a separate note, he does these wonderful book covers of books that have never been written that are absolutely fantastic. But the point about why this article is such a triumph, it really is... what would we call it? It is a very amusing philosophical meditation on the nature of failure. There you go. And what it's a great example of is that often when cricket writing is at its best, it's that it's not about cricket at all. It's cricket as a window onto life. And I think this again is the kind of piece that in the majority of sports journalism, you are quite tied to writing directly about the sport. You write about aspects of the sport, and this is just such a glorious piece because in many ways it's barely about cricket at all. It's really about this whole thing of growing up and getting to terms with the fact that you're not quite the quite the person you expected yourself to be. God, we're getting onto depressing territory. But
anyway, there we go. So to talk about cricket, we have to talk about anything but. So next episode, who knows what's going to happen? That was the 72nd episode. 78th. God, it's all passing quickly, isn't it? 78th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. As usual, you can find us over on Twitter at Reverse Swept.
If you have any reflections on the depressing nature of the aging process, then get in at Reverse Swept.